All right, good morning. So we have Bio 231, and I'd like to look at the syllabus that you have right here. And so today is September 24th. It's Wednesday, the 24th. And when the heck is our next test?
The 6th.
Oh, it's not next week. Okay, it's on a Monday, the week after next. So you got a little ways, but this chapter is going to be on. As a matter of fact, this is going to be the last chapter that's on the test. Okay, I wonder why I put it off. Probably because there are practicums in lab or something. Maybe that's why I put off the exam a little bit. So I hope you appreciate that, and I hope that doesn't mess up your schedule or your studying since I put off the test. But that might be a good thing for some people, and maybe for most people it doesn't matter. I'm not sure. But we'll try it this way anyway this semester, okay? All right. So today, we're going to go on to articulations. What the heck is what is an articulation? It's a joint. That's right. Oh, you know, but before I start, I do want to mention something. I've changed my office hours on Monday, Wednesday. Instead of right after class, I'm going to take a half hour break. So it's going to be from 12:30 to 1:30. Okay, so that changes. Same room. What's my room number? Why is that really easy to remember? Because it's on the board? Yeah, because my room number is like the number of days in a year.
Well, yeah.
It's really easy to remember that, sort of. Just a little bit of a twist, okay? And then I also had a question about Open Lab. Open Lab has not changed. Open Lab, I'll hold my office hours in the anatomy lab, which is officially SEM 335. And that is Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 until 12:20. So some of you might be interested in stopping in if you have time. Maybe you have other classes at that time, but you're welcome to come in. And I try to remember to bring your tests along with you, but of course you have all the models to look at. All right, so where else can you go to look at those models? Friday at 4:30. For I think a half hour, Dr. Sanchez has open lab. It's not in that room, but it's on that floor someplace. I forget what room number it is, but it's the other anatomy lab. And then other than that, tutoring in the LLRC. They have models over there. So you can go and look at that schedule, and you can use those models whenever there's a tutor in the room. So that's the availability for outside study in the course. Does anybody have any questions over the axial skeleton or appendicular skeleton? Because we've covered that. And I'm sure you all are doing really good. And you want to do good with bones because, like I said, you learn so much other anatomy just by knowing bones. Okay, you know, learn nomenclature and a little bit of the language, plus how to name other structures in your body. Okay. All right, well, let's move on to articulations or joints. Now, this lecture might not be quite as fun as some other lectures. This lecture is a little bit like physiology because we have to learn some functions of things. So it might take just a little bit more thinking than most other kinds of lectures. So if it doesn't make perfect sense to you, the ways that you could help yourself is that you can do the pre-lecture reading assignment and homework before coming to lecture. Right, it won't help for today, but maybe for next time. So don't forget, you have those pre-reading lecture assignments that you can fill out ahead of time, and that kind of gets you geared up for lecture. That would have helped today. I should have mentioned that last time. Okay, and then, of course, what is another great something that you can take advantage of to help prepare for the test? I forgot to mention this. What somebody said way back in the room, it kind of echoed around the room. That's the SI session. That's right. Oh, is that what you said? No, what did you say? Did you say something else that was good? I don't know who said it. But anyway, don't forget about supplemental instruction. Okay. And so when is that? Today, 12:30 to 2 o'clock, LRC 116. All right, and while you're there, you can find out where the tutor room is, for instance. It might even be the same room. It's not.
Next door.
Okay, well, you can find your way around. All right, so let's talk about articulations and joints. Okay, we can classify joints a couple of different ways. But what the heck is a joint? A joint is where two bones come together, right? Two separate bones, and they don't ossify. For instance, in the ascoxae, the ilium and the ischium and pubis all come together and they fuse. We don't really call that a joint anymore. Once bones fuse together, it's no longer a joint. So a joint is some kind of connection between bones that has not completely ossified. And they give the... Does anybody see my cursor anywhere? Ah, there it is. How come it's not a nice arrow? I don't know. All right, well anyway, a joint gives the human skeleton mobility and the ability to hold itself together. It supports our weight. Right? And joints are classified either by their structure or their function. So what does that mean? A joint is classified by its, what's a couple other words that you could use, by its anatomy, or you could classify a joint by its physiology as well. So you're going to have to always think in two dimensions, not just one dimension during this lecture, but two dimensions. And the two dimensions are what? One is structure or anatomy, and the other dimension is physiology or function. Right, so that's why this lecture is just a little bit confusing. But we're going to break it down first into the structural classification versus functional classification. So let's just start with one. A structural classification is based on the material that binds the bones together. These joints can be classified as a fibrous joint. Guess what kind of fibers those are? You probably know a little bit about that already. What kind of fibers might you guess? What kind of fibers have you heard about?
Collagen,
exactly right. Right? Collagen fibers. Some joints are cartilaginous in nature, and you should have maybe a picture in your mind of what cartilage looks like. And some kinds of cartilage have a lot of fibers in them. What kind of cartilage has a lot of fibers? Like fibrocartilage. Yeah, we're going to look at some joints that have fibrocartilage. And then the third kind of joint, by its anatomy, by structure, is what we call a synovial joint. So we're going to look at a special structure of synovial joints. That's a classification all by themselves, and we're going to look at a lot of detail of a synovial joint today. All right, the second classification, the second large classification, is the functional classification, or how it behaves in our body. It focuses on the amount of movement allowed. So these joints are either a synarthrosis, and synarthrosis is an immovable joint. A good example of that would be a suture. Where do we have sutures? You don't go to the emergency room for this kind of suture. All right, in your skull, right? So the joints of the cranial bones form sutures. Even your facial bones are sutures as well. And those typically don't move around. Like you don't see anybody like on a science fiction movie when they talk to like a Martian, their head is moving back and forth, right? Our cranial bones don't move like that. So they are what? Immovable. And in particular, we call that a synarthrosis. The next kind is slightly movable. For instance, intervertebral joints that have discs between them. You can rotate a little bit. You can flex and extend a little bit, maybe even a little lateral flexion and extension as well, okay, at a vertebral disc, but not a whole lot. All right, we call that an amphiarthrosis. And then the third kind, of course, is freely movable. These joints can articulate or move according to how they were designed, and we're going to look at the design of a number of diarthrotic joints. A good example would be an elbow, and the simplest way to think of an elbow is to go into anatomic position, all right, and decrease the angle of the forearm to the arm and move like this. All right, there's another motion that's allowed, but this motion right here is flexion and extension. And we're going to look at what makes the elbow, or what gives it the ability to flex and extend. And actually, you know some of those parts of the bone already. Like on the ulna, you have the trochlear notch, and on the humerus, you have the trochlea. It's that articulation, those two bones coming together at that location, that allow you to flex and extend the elbow very nicely. All right, so that would be a diarthrosis. So fibrous, cartilaginous, synovial, that's a pretty easy list to remember, but how the heck are you going to remember synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, or diarthrosis? There's a little trick that I try to use sometimes, and maybe someone else has got a pretty good idea. All right. Remember, you always start with what? The least movable, and you end up with the most movable. And somebody, I think, said it, if you just look at the first letter of those words, it just spells out sad. Not that you're sad when you study anatomy, but that's just a little trick you can use. Yeah. Are you thinking of that too? Okay. Just SAD. And remember, that's immovable synarthrosis, a slightly movable amphiarthrosis, and fully movable diarthrosis. And this classification is by what? By anatomy or by physiology? By physiology, right. Okay. All right, so let's look at some fibrous joints in particular. And fibrous joints are what kind of classification? Anatomical classification or a physiology classification? It's anatomic, right? It's by structure. Okay. So it's a structural kind of classification. So fibrous joints are connected by dense, regular connective tissue. You should have a picture in your mind of what that looks like. That's very dense collagen. All the collagen is aligned in parallel sheets, right, or collinear sheets. And the first kind of fibrous joint is a suture. And we've talked about that already, right? It has collagen in that particular joint. But what else do we know about a suture? It is also, if we think in terms of physiology and not just anatomy, it is what? Immovable. And it's located between skull bones. So if it's immovable, by function, what is this kind of joint? It's a synarthrosis. Okay. So here is a nice picture. And we can see some cranial bones right here. And here are all of those collagen fibers that are attaching these bones together. Okay, so this is immovable, or very, very, very slightly movable, but hardly movable at all. Okay, another kind of joint, right, is a syndemosis. This is connected exclusively by ligaments, and the amount of movement varies depending on exactly what kind of joint it is. Different joints that are syndemoses in your body have different kinds of motion. So, for instance, and we've looked at these already, like the distal tibiofibular joint. So that's a joint between the tibia and fibula. Remember that interosseous membrane? Okay. So that's a synarthrosis. That's, That's not the interosseous membrane. That's the actual joint. Let's take a look. Right here. Okay, between the tibia and the fibula, and that stabilizes the association between the tibia and the fibula right here. So that is immovable. So how would we classify an immovable joint by function? That's a synarthrosis, right? All right, so it's also a fibrous by anatomy. And then the next kind that we were going to look at over here is a gomphosis. Is that the next one? Yeah, a gomphosis. That's a peg and socket joint. And here is a real good example. For instance, we have a tooth right here filling in the alveolus within a mandible or the maxilla, and there are ligaments that hold the tooth in place. And of course, you don't want your teeth wiggling around or falling out of these alveoli when you're chewing. So these ligaments right here, which we call periodontal. Peri means surrounding, and dentitia or dontal just means tooth. These are ligaments that surround the whole tooth and anchor it into the socket or the alveolus in your jaw, either your upper jaw or lower jaw. And probably some of you have felt that ligament in your lifetime. Maybe you were eating something and all of a sudden there was something hard in what you were eating and you bit down and you felt a sharp pain in your tooth, and thank goodness it didn't crack. All right. That hard little object, like maybe you're eating a hamburger or something that had a little fleck of bone or something in it, and you chewed down and you weren't expecting that little fleck of bone right there, and you couldn't occlude your teeth properly, and so it tweaked the tooth, it bent it over to the side, and it stretched out these ligaments. And when those ligaments stretch out, that produces kind of an acute pain that you feel right away, but chances are it really didn't damage anything. Okay, so you do have pain nerve endings in all of these different ligaments. Okay, so these are what we call fibrous joints. All right, cartilaginous joints. Again, that's a type of structural or anatomic classification. Bones are united by cartilage. And again, it doesn't have a joint cavity. Now, the same thing for a fibrous joint. It doesn't have a joint cavity, and we're going to have to wait and see what a joint cavity is until we get to a synovial joint. But that's the next one coming up. All right, so again, no joint cavity for a fibrous joint, no joint cavity for a cartilaginous. And we've got two kinds of cartilaginous joints. The first kind is a synchondrosis. Now, how could you guess that that's a cartilaginous joint? Because you see chondro in that word right there. All right, so these are united by hyaline cartilage. These are immovable. All right, so if they're immovable, what kind of functional classification is that? That's a synarthrosis, right, or immovable. Some examples of that would be the epiphyseal disc. Can you remember where the epiphyseal disc is? That is in a long bone. That's the point where the long bone grows in length before puberty is reached, right? That's an epiphyseal disc. And that should move. And if it does move, I think we talked about that, if for some reason a lot of force is applied to that epiphyseal disc and it moves, what's a likely result? A likely result to that, since it's supposed to be a synarthrosis, right, it's going to damage that joint. And since that joint is responsible for growth, and that bone might not grow properly at that location. Okay, so that's sort of serious. Okay, because it's only hyaline cartilage and it's easy to damage. Compression, twisting, or even pulling. And I don't know if I have a picture of that. I don't think I do. Oh yeah, right here. All right, so here's a synchondrosis right over here. Okay, another kind is a symphysis. This is united by fibrocartilage. It's slightly movable, so by function, what do we call a slightly movable joint? That's an amphi, that's the A in SAD, that's an amphiarthrosis, slightly movable. And good examples of these would be the intervertebral discs as well as the pubic symphysis. And I think I did talk about the pubic symphysis last time in class. All right, so here is a nice example of the fibrocartilage, at least the outer ring of an intervertebral disc is fibrocartilage. And this is slightly movable or amphiarthrosis kind of joint. Okay, so those are some good examples. Okay, the next kind of joint, by structure, by its anatomy, are freely movable joints, or synovial joints. So we use these terms interchangeably, but remember, synovial is a classification by structure, and freely movable is a classification by function. And a freely movable, again, is what? A diarthrosis. So all synovial joints are diarthrosis. They all move. You'll never find an exception to that rule. All right, so synovial joints are characterized by a joint cavity that's filled with fluid. So we're going to see what makes up that joint cavity. And, well, I said this already, they're all freely movable. And most of the joints in our body are of this kind of classification. So most bones can move, or most joints can move. So here are the parts of a synovial joint. We didn't have to know the different parts of a cartilaginous joint or fibrous joint. Actually, there's only one kind of part in a fibrous joint. What's the part of a fibrous joint? What's inside that fibrous joint? Is collagen. Yeah, suture would be an example. There's just collagen. So it only has one part, and it's collagen. What's the part of a cartilaginous joint? It's going to be cartilage, either hyaline cartilage or fibrocartilage. That's the only part of these kinds of joints. But a synovial joint, because they're special, because they're freely movable, they have more parts. They've got more pieces to them. And so we're just going to look at just a general synovial joint and apply that model to all the joints in our body. All right, so all synovial joints have articular cartilage, joint cavities, synovial membrane, synovial fluid, a fibrous capsule, and a joint capsule. So let's look at all these different pieces of a synovial joint. So here is an illustration of a typical kind of synovial joint, just a general synovial joint. It doesn't have everything in it that every synovial joint has, but it has most of the pieces. And I'll mention some pieces that are missing from this one. Well, it looks like we have a couple long bones right here, for example. And on the distal epiphysis of the first long bone and the proximal epiphysis of the second long bone forming this joint, we have articular cartilage or hyaline cartilage. And the job of this cartilage is to protect the bone matrix so that when these bones move, the bones don't grind each other down, which would be the case if that hyaline is not there. Okay, so we don't want our bones to get ground down. That's a pathological condition. And what's the name of that pathology? When somebody is missing cartilage in their joints and the bones are actually grinding each other away, that is arthritis, right? So there's a couple different forms of arthritis, for instance, like osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis, different kinds of arthritis, and even just overuse injuries can produce arthritis as well. All right, so that's hyaline cartilage. And that hyaline cartilage is very soft, but it is slippery. But because it is soft, it can be damaged pretty easily. Okay, so that's on the epiphyses of the bones. And surrounding the hyaline cartilage is a fluid. And that, so we call that synovial fluid. And that synovial fluid is really the only nourishment that this hyaline cartilage gets. So it helps hydrate the hyaline cartilage and nourish it a little bit and keeps it slippery. But there are no blood vessels in the cartilage, so when this cartilage is damaged, it just won't heal by itself at all. Right, and if it forms a flap or something in a joint, then it has to be removed. So the synovial fluid kind of maintains to some degree the hyaline cartilage. We call that synovial fluid, and that synovial fluid is in this cavity, which is what we call the joint cavity. So we never saw the cavity in a fibrous joint or cartilaginous joint. So a fibrous or cartilaginous joint does not have synovial fluid, only synovial joints do. And this fluid comes from the synovial membrane, which is the deepest layer of the joint capsule. And the synovial membrane right here is responsible for producing synovial fluid. So there are capillaries in the synovial membrane. And of course, if the synovial membrane gets damaged, it will start leaking fluid into a joint, and that will decrease mobility of that joint. And you'll have fluid building up, inappropriate levels of fluid within that particular synovial joint. All right, but the synovial membrane is not very strong. So there has to be another membrane, right, that goes across the joint, and we call that the fibrous capsule. And the fibrous capsule is dense, irregular connective tissue, so there's a lot of collagen, and to some degree that stabilizes the joint. But it's not super strong like a tendon or ligament. All right, that's just the strong backing layer for the synovial membrane. And if we put the synovial membrane together with the fibrous capsule, that's what forms the articular capsule. So that's another way that you could possibly damage a joint. If you use a joint inappropriately, you could damage the joint capsule. You could stretch the synovial membrane or this fibrous capsule right here. And that will more or less heal because the synovial membrane is vascular. And then even further, on the outside, we have other kinds of connective tissue, for instance, like this ligament that is going to go from one bone to the other, and that's further going to protect the joint capsule. Okay, and that is dense, regular connective tissue. Okay, and the periosteum is just continuous with all these different layers that we've talked about. Okay, and that's just the outer membrane on the bone. So this is a nice typical kind of synovial joint. And in a few synovial joints, we have some additional cartilage within the joint cavity itself. And for instance, if we were going to look at a knee, that additional fibrocartilage that's in the joint, we would call that a meniscus. But there are only a few joints in our body that have menisci. The knee is one, and there is another one probably nobody really knows about, but for instance, I'll give you a hint. If you have problems with this joint that has a meniscus in it, it's another one besides the knee, if you have problems with it, you would probably go and talk to a dentist about it. What joint would that be? Yeah, the temporomandibular joint right here. That's another fairly complicated joint and can be damaged. There is also a meniscus in that joint as well, okay, which is fibrocartilage. Ah, what do we have right here? Okay, here is, so what kind of joint is this by structure? What are the kinds? There's fibrous, cartilaginous, and synovial. Which one does this look like? It's synovial because it's got all those pieces in there, right? You see the joint cavity right here, and you see articular cartilage. Now this one here, all right, I have to correct myself. You do have a picture of a joint that has a meniscus in it, and generally speaking, that meniscus would be an articular disc. And that furthermore protects the ends of the bones that are articulating with each other. Okay, so this articular disc is just a generalized form of, for instance, the meniscus that you have, or the menisci that you have in your knees. Okay, so what do you got? You got hyaline cartilage, articular disc, you got the joint cavity. What's inside this joint cavity? Synovial fluid. That synovial fluid is coming from the synovial membrane. Okay, it just weeps synovial fluid into the space right here. And then you have the fibrous capsule. And if we put the synovial membrane together with the fibrous capsule, we have the joint capsule. Okay. All right, so this would be another good example of a joint cavity. Okay. And all synovial joints are freely movable. What's the term for freely movable? Diarthroses. Okay. All right, so make sure you work the homework. Okay. Other kinds of things that a synovial joint might have is that they, I did mention reinforcing ligaments already, but they might have nerves and other kinds of blood vessels, and they might have bursa, and they might have a tendon sheath. And I haven't showed you these things yet, but we did talk about, what, this articular disc or meniscus. So let's see if we can find a bursa or a tendon sheath to find out what these things look like. All right, so I think a good place to go look for those would be in the shoulder, for instance. All right, so here's a nice cross-section of a shoulder. All right, so here's the head of the humerus, and we've got the nice acromion process of the scapula. And what does this look like here? That's the glenoid cavity of the scapula. And you can see that that depression is not very deep. Right there, it's a very shallow depression. And that accepts the head of the humerus. And we see a tendon from the biceps brachii, and that tendon goes right between two big large bumps near the head of the humerus. What are those two big bumps called? They are the tubercles, like the greater tubercle and lesser tubercle. And what's between the tubercles? There is a intertubercular groove. There's a depression running between the tubercles. And this is where that tendon of the biceps runs, right in that intertubercular groove. So I don't see the tubercles on this side, but what I do see is what? The space that the tendon of the biceps brachii is lying in, and that would be the intertubercular groove. And the tendon of the biceps brachii courses completely over the head of the humerus and inserts into that superior little thing on the top of the glenoid fossa. Well, what did we call that? Is it listed on this thing? No, it's not listed on the slide, but I asked you to know that. Okay, what is a place for a muscle attachment called on a bone? That's a process. This has a special name because it's a tiny process. It is a, okay, it is the, it's a tubercle. I had to think what it was called. It's a tubercle. A tubercle is just a small process, but it's rough and it's raised. And the function of that is for muscle attachment, so the biceps is attaching right here. This is the supraglenoid tubercle. All right? And down over here is going to be the infraglenoid tubercle. It's not on this slide, but it's good to review a little bit. So the biceps inserts into the supraglenoid tubercle, and the one that inserts here is the muscle in the posterior arm. That's going to be the triceps. Okay? So this tendon is moving pretty radically all the time because you use your shoulder a lot. You use your biceps a lot with your arms raised, your arms are lowered, out to the side, okay, because this is a nice synovial joint right here. So this tendon is moving around all the time, and that could cause inflammation of the shoulder joint or the glenohumeral joint. So there is something special that protects, right, the tendon from inflammation and the joint from inflammation, and that is what we call a tendon sheath. So you see the tendon moving through this tendon sheath, and that's basically a pillow right? So you can see it's just a kind of like a little sac that's formed around this tendon right here. And it has a fibrous capsule and it has a synovial membrane. And that synovial membrane is secreting what to the inside of this tendon sheath? Synovial fluid. So this helps reduce friction, but it also absorbs shock and it protects the head of the humerus and the tendon of the biceps brachii. And it's slippery, it rolls around, right? So it allows for motion without producing any friction. So this is a nice tendon sheath. So a tendon sheath is something that surrounds a tendon that reduces friction and inflammation. And it has components just like a typical synovial joint. Doesn't have cartilage, but it has a synovial membrane and synovial fluid inside of it. So it's slippery on the inside. Okay, so there's something else here too. There is no articular cartilage between the acromion process and the head of the humerus, but yet they're very close to each other. They're moving with respect to each other, but it's a larger space. And in this larger space between some ligaments of the shoulder joint and the head of the humerus and the acromion process, there is something else that looks a lot like a tendon sheath. And this is what we call a bursa. Right, so here is the subacromial bursa. Again, it looks like a joint capsule. So we have a fibrous capsule and synovial membrane and synovial fluid on the inside of it. And again, this is kind of like a little roly-poly structure that allows the humerus to move around, but it prevents the friction and it prevents inflammation in the shoulder. Now, if you overuse your shoulder or use it inappropriately, the wrong kind of motion, right, the tendon sheath can become inflamed, the bursa can become inflamed, and it will swell up. And whenever you use that shoulder, that swelling is going to produce pain, and that's going to, what, produce even more inflammation. So it's kind of a nasty situation because that inflammation causes more inflammation. That's a positive cycle that develops. And what do we call that condition when a bursa gets damaged and inflamed? That's called bursitis. And you have bursa in different joints in your body, like your hip joints. So wherever two bones sort of approximate each other, that come close together and they start to, and they move up against each other, you might have a bursa there. Or even better is where you have a muscle that runs very close to bone, and that muscle might bang up against the bone. That bursa is there to prevent that friction and that inflammation from taking place. Okay, so a tendon sheath and a bursa are almost the same thing, except the tendon sheath completely surrounds a tendon. All right, so the functioning of a synovial joint is possible because friction is reduced by the joint mechanism of weeping lubrication, right? That lubricates the synovial membrane as well as the hyaline cartilage. So there are several factors that influence the stability of synovial joints. Well, let's go back to the other kinds of joints. Besides synovial, remember, what kind of joint is synovial? By what kind of classification? By function or by structure? Okay. Well, you know what? It's really by function, okay? But it does have a lot of structure associated with it. Synovial is by function. It's freely movable, right? It's a diarthrosis. Did I have that up there? Oh, I have it as a structural classification. Sorry to give you a curveball. It is by structure because of all the pieces that make up a synovial joint. Let's talk about what stabilizes a synovial joint, okay, because a synovial joint is freely movable, but the other kinds of joints by function, what are the other, no, by structure, let's stay with structure. What are the other kinds of joints by structure? There is fibrous, right, and cartilaginous. All right, so fibrous and cartilaginous joints really don't move very much, so we're not really concerned about how to stabilize a fibrous or a cartilaginous joint because their inherent nature is what? They are stable. They really don't move. Okay? But a synovial joint is freely movable, so we should be concerned about how we stabilize synovial joints. Okay, so these are the ways that synovial joints are stabilized. By the shapes of the articulating surfaces. And we're going to look at a number of synovial joints by the shape of the articulating surfaces. A joint that I mentioned before is the joint between that is formed by the trochlea and the trochlear notch. It looks a lot like a door hinge. So your forearm can just flex and extend, right, just in one degree of freedom. So the shapes of the articulating surfaces. There is something else, and that is ligaments that go from one bone to the other that cross the joint. All right, so ligaments help stabilize a joint. And then the third factor, which actually probably is the most important, is the tone of the muscles whose tendons actually cross the joint. So it's actually muscles that stabilize a joint more than any other thing. And if a joint is damaged, then you're not guaranteed that those two bones are going to heal and actually give you the same shape that you were born with in that particular joint. So you might have some kind of jagged bone or something within a joint that's not going to work as well. And ligaments, right, that's dense, regular connective tissue, does not have a blood supply or vascular supply. So once a ligament is damaged, it really won't go back to its original shape or its strength. So when a joint is damaged, you can't rely on ligaments or the shape of these articulating surfaces to again stabilize that joint. So after an injury, what is really the only thing that you can really do to help stabilize a joint again is to work the muscles that act across that joint. So muscle exercise is the best way to stabilize that joint, but that really does, muscles don't have anything to do with the skeletal system. We haven't talked about muscles yet. So if I was going to pick something very important, I would say condition number 3 right here is probably the most important thing. And the exercise would be the proper exercise for that particular joint. All right, now we talked about bursas and tendon sheaths already, so I'm not going to go over that again. Let's see what the next couple pictures are. Okay. All right, so movements that are allowed. Now, what kind of joint is allowed to move? Synovial, right? And it's freely movable, so it's a diarthrosis. Generally, 3 basic kinds of motion. The gliding of one bone across another. Okay, gliding would be like right over, like my mouse is gliding over the tabletop right here. Okay, it's just kind of 2 flat surfaces are just sliding over each other. Then there are angular movements, and here are 3 different kinds of angular movements. We have flexion and extension. Okay, let's see if we can show you flexion and extension in a nice diagram right here. Okay, let's work with an arm because that's easy to look at. Let's work with this. So what part of the body is this between your knee and your ankle? That's your leg, right? That's your leg. And in anatomic position, your leg is extended. So the definition for extension is when you increase the angle between 2 bones. So let's think of the bones of the leg and the femur and the thigh. When we increase that angle, that is called extension. And when we decrease that angle, when you bring your heel up toward your buttocks, that angle is decreasing. We call that flexion. So that's a nice definition for extension and flexion. And that's just 1 degree of freedom. You can move your arm, you can either flex or extend, and that's about it. And on the word slide, these motions are what we call antagonistic to each other. Right? So flexion is the opposite motion compared to extension. So I can flex and extend my arm. My leg, but also I can flex and extend my forearm. So this right here is what we call, what was that motion? So this is flexion because we're decreasing the angle between these 2 bones, and extension is making the angle get bigger, right? Okay, so how can you talk about that motion? Flexion and extension. 2 different ways. You could say flexion of the forearm, or you could say, what joint is being flexed? What joint is flexion occurring at? The elbow, right? So you could say, well, that's flexion at the elbow, or that's flexion of the forearm, and it's the same motion. This is extension of the forearm or extension at the elbow. We probably use those terms interchangeably, and so you should just picture what's going on there. And one motion is exactly opposite the other, and that's an antagonistic motion. All right, now I want to talk a little bit about the connotation that you might have for antagonism. So before taking this class, if you've heard that word antagonistic, what kind of connotation do you have? Is it kind of a good thing or a bad thing? Like, do you want to be around antagonistic people all the time? No, you want to be around people that are nice, right? Okay, not antagonistic. But I want to change your opinion about the importance of this term right here and whether it is a good or bad thing. In terms of physiology and anatomy, it just means that things are controlled by two mechanisms that work in opposition to each other. So flexion and extension work in opposition to each other, but a result of that is means that your body has precise control and balance over itself because these two mechanisms work in opposition to each other. All right, because you have muscles that will flex the forearm, namely the biceps, and muscles that will extend the forearm, namely the triceps, you can position your hand or your forearm in any precise location in space. So if you didn't have antagonistic control and you started to extend, what would happen? If you didn't have a biceps and you started to extend, what would happen to your hand? I mean, it would just go flying out in front of you, right? And you might even damage your elbow as a result of that. But because the elbow is controlled by antagonistic mechanisms, namely flexion and extension, or the work of the biceps and the triceps, you have precise control over your fingertip. And that could be really handy, say this weekend. Why could it be really handy this weekend? Maybe Friday night, you get pulled over by that person in the blue uniform and the badge and the fancy cap and the sidearm, and they say, oh, I want you to take your fingertip, right? And close your eyes and put it right on the tip of your nose. I did pretty good. All right, right on the tip of your nose. And you're going to say, well, of course, officer, I can do that because I have precise control and balance due to some what? Antagonistic mechanism in my forearm. And you can close your eye. And but you know what? Now, you might not want to mention that antagonistic term to the officer, okay, because I don't know if they've taken an anatomy and physiology class. But you should appreciate what those antagonistic mechanisms are really a good thing for you to have. And if you lose that antagonistic control, what's going to happen? You're going to poke the officer in the eye or yourself in the eye, right? And then you won't go home that night, right? So antagonism in terms of physiology and anatomy or in terms of control systems is very important to have, right? And your body is designed to employ antagonistic mechanisms all the time in terms of hormonal regulation, in terms of the musculoskeletal system. And we're going to point some of these things out throughout the class. And as a matter of fact, you know, this term right here is probably the most important concept that you can learn and apply in an anatomy class and a physiology class. It's probably the most important thing that you'll learn in here. Okay. Okay, another antagonistic motion, which is what? Good or bad? Very, very good, is abduction and adduction. So various parts of your body can move away from midline, like your arms can move away from midline, raising your hands up to your sides. We call that abduction, with a B, abduction. Or you can lower your hands back down to your side. We call that adduction. And they're what? They're opposite motions. But because they're antagonistic motions, you have precise control and balance over that part of your body. All right, so your arm, we said, or your forearm can flex and extend, but can it abduct or adduct at the elbow? No, you don't ever want to do that. That would be bad. That would damage that joint, right? But of course, your shoulder can because it has a different structure. So we're going to look at the structure of those joints and see why one allows you only to flex and extend and the other can even adduct and abduct. And the shoulder is a special kind of joint because it's a ball and socket joint. So not only can you flex and extend at the shoulder, you can abduct and adduct at the shoulder and even do things in between at the shoulder, which is this kind of motion, making a windmill like this. This is flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, all at the same time, and we call that circumduction. So circumduction is not antagonistic. It's just a very complicated kind of motion. All right. So most of these motions are easy to see in terms of flexion and extension. Here we see flexion at the knee or flexion of the leg. Extension is bringing it back down. At the elbow, it's really easy to see. Now, what about the hip? I don't think I have a picture of the hip. So let's talk about flexion and extension of the hip, and I'll give you an example of that. So flexion would be what? Increasing or decreasing the angle between bones? So flexion is decreasing. So to flex across my hip, I would have to bring my thigh. It doesn't matter what your leg is doing. It's only your thigh. So bringing your thigh up to your torso is flexion at the hip. Okay? And then bringing your thigh back down is increasing the angle. That's extension. So that's extension of the hip. So that's a little bit, once you see it, that's not too hard to comprehend. But there is one joint that, even for me today, is incomprehensible. So I want to, but I'll show you how to remember that. Okay, and that is the shoulder joint. Flexion and extension at the shoulder. Flexion and extension of the elbow, easy to see. But what about the shoulder? Okay, this right here is what we call flexion, and this is what we call extension. Now, I don't see any joint angle increasing or decreasing anywhere. And furthermore, some joints can hyperextend. So this is hyperextension. So how can you remember this is flexion at the shoulder? And again, it doesn't matter what my hands or forearm is doing. Flexion of the shoulder, extension. All right, well, that motion is going to parallel the motion of your hip. So this is flexion of the hip, flexion of the shoulder, extension of the hip, extension at the shoulder. Right, flexion and extension. And maybe they named it that way just because of that motion. I don't know. But if you ever find out, look in Wikipedia sometime. All right, so bringing your upper appendage from in front of your body to more anatomical position, that's extension, then moving it posterior is hyperextension. So some joints you can hyperextend, no problem. Other joints you don't want to hyperextend. What's a good joint that you could think of that you don't want to hyperextend? Your elbow, you can flex and you can extend, but you don't want to hyperextend it because something's going to break inside that joint. Okay. The vertebral column. You can flex by bending forward like that. Okay, I can still flex my cervical vertebral column. All right, so that's flexion and extension. And what about hyperextension? A little bit. You can hyperextend, okay, just not drastically, not with a lot of trauma. Okay. All right, so those are some important kinds of motions. Oh, yeah, so here's flexion and extension. This is more of a lumbar region that's being flexed. Extension and hyperextension going back. But be careful of those intervertebral discs. Be careful how you hyperextend. Okay, other kinds of motions. Oh, yeah, I talked about the windmill motion with your shoulder joint. There's another joint. You only have one other joint that you can perform circumduction with. Guess what joint that is? That's your hip, right? You can circumduct. So you can flex your hip. You can extend, probably even hyperextend a little bit. And this motion is abduction. You can adduct with your hip. And, of course, you can do circumduction as well with your hip. Okay. And so not only can you abduct and adduct your appendages, but you can abduct and adduct your digits. So, for instance, when Spock is giving the peace sign or whatever it is, what's he doing to his fingers from Star Trek? He is abducting, right, when he does that. Oh, that's difficult. I'm out of practice, right? And then when you put your fingers together, that is adduction. So abduction, adduction. And your toes can do that too, right? Okay. Rotation. Just think of the humerus by itself. I'm going to move different parts of my body when I talk, but just think of my humerus. So I'm going to flex my elbow right here, but my humerus really hasn't moved at all. My forearm has moved. Right, and now I'm going to rotate my hand so it comes into my belly button. That's what we would call a medial rotation. Not a medial rotation of this part, right? Not of my forearm or hand, but a medial rotation of my humerus. It's rotating within my shoulder joint. This would be a lateral rotation. So the humerus is rotating back and forth, right? Medial rotation, lateral rotation. Other kinds of rotation, I couldn't tell you. if it's medial or lateral, you can rotate between two bones in your cervical spine. Okay, this is a rotation. It's neither flexion or extension. All right, so this motion would be a right lateral rotation. This motion would be a left lateral rotation. There's no such thing as medial and lateral rotation of the cervical spine. So what two bones are rotating, are pivoting around each other? They're between C1 and C2, or the atlas and the axis, right? That kind of motion is allowed. That's rotation. And you could probably rotate your femur to some degree as well. This is a real handy motion to be aware of because it's used diagnostically all the time to diagnose the shoulder joint. There is, when we get into muscles, we're going to look at something called rotator cuff. Anybody ever hear of a rotator cuff injury? It's an injury to the shoulder. And a really quick diagnostic that you could perform to see if somebody has a rotator cuff injury, for instance, you tell them, flex at the elbow, do a medial rotation, apply some force right here, and if they can resist that force, if they can press on that force, then without screaming in agony, then they have a pretty healthy shoulder. But if it's acute pain, then that's a rotator cuff injury. So we use these all the time clinically. So if you're interested, if you have rotator cuff, we could show you very easily today. Okay, a couple other motions. These sometimes can be difficult to appreciate. Some are the most complicated. Now your elbow right here, we said you can flex and can extend, but there's another motion, and that is you can have your palms facing anteriorly, or you can move your palms so that they face posteriorly. And that happens, okay, at the elbow, but between the capitulum and the head of the radius, because remember that capitulum kind of looks like a ball, so it sort of looks like a shoulder or a hip joint. All right, so it allows for this kind of motion. Now, this is neither flexion or extension. All right, so this right here, this motion, is called pronation, and moving your palms facing anterior like this is called supination. So in anatomical position, you're like this, right? So pronation is when you move the palms of your hands posteriorly. That's pronation. And supination is when you move the palms of your hands anteriorly. Best way to remember that is pronation is what? Palms posterior. That's an easy way to remember that. What are other people teach other little tricks to remember that motion? Like, for instance, when you do this, how are your hands? Are they pronated or supinated? They're supinated. So if you kind of flex your digits like that and put your hands together, what do you have? You have a soup bowl right there. Okay? I know I teach you a lot of silly things in here, but that's easy to remember. Okay, so supination, pronation. You got to look at that a couple times. Another motion that clinically is really important as well, okay, is the motion at your ankle. Now, if you look at your lower appendage compared to your upper appendage in anatomical position, and you flex at the elbow, right, that means your hand comes anteriorly. But now let's go to the lower appendage, and if you flex at the knee, does your foot move anteriorly?
No.
It moves posteriorly. So the upper appendage, the arrangement of your upper appendage compared to your lower appendage is kind of twisted and screwed up, basically. Okay, I mean, it works really nice, but it's different. So in terms of the ankle, we don't have a clear definition for flexion and extension. So we come up with two other terms, and that's because the ankle is twisted and the knee is twisted around. They're both called flexion, but one is called dorsiflexion and the other is called plantar flexion. So plantar flexion is when you point your toes into the ground. That's plantar flexion. So moving your toes into the ground. And we're going to look at some muscles that do all this kind of stuff. Dorsiflexion is when you lift your toes up off the ground. Like when you're walking. You should always dorsiflex. Because what would happen if you don't? You're going to trip. Yeah, you're going to trip on a crack in the sidewalk or fall or something. And, you know, it used to be when doctors had time, you know, they actually have you walk into the room and you'd kind of look at a person and kind of look and see how they were dressed and, you know, what they kind of looked like and how they talked and how they walked and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of the good doctors could make a diagnosis just by looking at a patient walk in the room. Okay, but today there's no time to do that. The patient's in the room and the doctor walks in, and what do they see? They just see a painting. And they don't see a patient moving, so it's difficult to tell. Okay, but there's a little clue. Okay, still, I would guess if you're an elderly person, a physician is going to look at the tips of your shoes. Okay, and he's going to then get an idea if you're dorsiflexing when you're walking or if you're not. Okay, because if you're not dorsiflexing, what can you tell me about the tips of your shoes? They're going to get all worn down. Okay, and that's a nice sign for spinal cord injury because there are spinal nerves that affect how those muscles operate, and you can just tell by looking at the soles of somebody's shoes. And why would that be important for an elderly person? Because you could probably save somebody's life by knowing that, because when you're in your 70s and 80s, and if you're having troubles dorsiflexing, you're walking around, you're going to trip, and you have osteoporosis by that time, and you fall. So what is one consequence of falling when you're in that age group? Broken hip, right? And you can't convalesce at home because it's a pretty serious injury. You usually go to a nursing home, and you're in a nursing home, you're away from your family and familiar surroundings, and people just kind of give up after that, right? So knowing these motions and cues to look at is very important. Yeah. Plantar fasciitis. It can have something to do with your gait, but it's probably, there are other contributions to that factor, like the kind of shoes that you wear, the other activity that you're doing, and even arch support, if you have normal arches. And also it has something to do with a motion that we don't talk a lot about in this class, and that is pronation and supination at the ankle, because they're combinations of joints. So if you're over supinating or pronating, that could put extra stress on the arch of the foot, and that will inflame that tendon, right, that's on the bottom of the foot right here. So it's usually a combination of maybe a little bit inappropriate exercise, inappropriate shoe, maybe a little bit of a congenital malformation of the foot in terms of the arches. So all those things kind of come together. Okay. And that can be kind of a nasty, I guess we have to call it a disease process. It could be kind of nasty. It might be so bad where the pain is so bad you don't even feel like walking. Okay. And probably the best way that I've heard from people and friends to combat plantar fasciitis is the appropriate exercise and walking combined with proper arches and shoes. But stretching probably is the most important thing. But if you have a jacuzzi at home, I'm sure that would help a lot too. Okay, just warming that part of your body up and exercising when it's warmed up. Okay. All right, so those are some motions. Now let's see, what else do we have? These last three, oh no, we didn't talk about inversion and eversion of the foot. I don't know if I have a slide of that. Oh yeah, I do. Okay, so here is the lateral malleolus. Here's the medial malleolus over here. So what bone is making the lateral malleolus up? That is the fibula, right? And the medial is the tibia. So if you bend your ankle so you're standing on your lateral malleolus like that, okay, that's inverting. And if you look at my ankle, you could probably go, oh, wow, you can like bend your ankle 90 degrees or more. It's because I've sprained it so many times. That's not normal. Okay, so inversion, eversion, I still have a pretty stable ankle that way. You have more ligaments that are preventing eversion of the foot. That would be like standing on your tibia. But if you ever do sprain your ankle with an eversion, that's a worse injury because the ankle is more stable in that direction. Okay, so inverting is easy to do. So inversion, eversion at the ankle. Protraction is pushing some part of your body anteriorly, like your shoulders, you can protract. Your shoulders, you can retract. Your mandible, carefully, don't chip a tooth. You can protract or retract your mandible because the TMJ joint allows that kind of motion. Okay, elevation and depression of the mandible for chewing as well. Elevating is bringing your teeth together, and depression is just opening your mouth. And then opposition you can do with your thumb and your other fingers, oppositional motion. So that's most of the motions that we're going to be interested with the exception of pronation and supination at the ankle. All right, so let's look at some shapes of joints. Okay, here are some shapes of joints. We have plane joints, hinge joints, pivot joints, condyloid, saddle joints, ball and socket joints. So plane joints, we say that's transitional. That means that that joint can move pretty much in any direction within a plane. A hinge joint is uniaxial, right? It can only move with one degree of freedom, just flexion and extension. Pivot is uniaxial too, right? It's just in one plane. Biaxial is motion in more than one plane. Like, what can you do with your thumb? You can move it anteriorly, posteriorly, opposition, okay, more than one dimension. And same thing for a saddle joint. And a ball and socket joint is multiaxial because what can it do? It can move in any old direction it wants to because it's a ball and socket. So if you were going to classify these joints by function, what would you classify all these joints as? This is just sort of a review of the first part of the lecture. They are a diarthrosis by function, and then by structure, what are they? This is where I messed up in the lecture. There are, by structure, it's called a, all of these are synovial joints. So we're going to look at some structure of synovial joints. Okay. All right, so a plane joint. Here we see a plane, this is easy for you guys because you can see colors. Okay. Plane joints between, okay, carpals in your wrist, for instance, would be a good example of that. All right, a hinge joint would be the ankle that I was talking about, and also hinge joints between the phalanges of your fingers. These are hinge joints. These joints you can't abduct or adduct either. Okay. All right, so these would be good examples. A pivot we talked about between C1 and C2. And also the proximal radial ulnar joint. Oh, yeah, I don't have a picture of that. But remember, you got the head of the radius that is very circular, and it inserts into the radial notch in the ulna so that you can pronate and supinate right here, so that the head of the radius is pivoting within that radial notch within the ulna. Okay, so that would be another example. I can't see these well enough to actually point these out. Okay, but did we talk about hinge yet? Oh yeah, hinge was the second one. Let's just look at this one. So here's a typical illustration of what a hinge joint is. Right, and so a typical hinge joint would be between the trochlea and the trochlear notch. So the ulna cannot pivot at all. It can only flex and extend because of what? The shape of the joint. Okay, here is a pivot joint this is a nice picture, where the head of the radius, right, can rotate within the radial notch of the ulna right here. And so that's a pivot joint. A condyloid joint, right, this is a biaxial motion, and that's between your proximal phalanx and a, what is this bone right here? A metacarpal, right? So this is a condyloid joint. Okay, so it can do what? Flex and extend, abduct, adduct. It can even circumduct. We don't talk about that very much. All right, so that's a multiaxial joint. Okay, a saddle joint between the first phalanx and, I'm sorry, no, this is the first metacarpal. Right, and this carpal right here, that's a saddle joint. And so again, that's a bidirectional kind of motion. And that joint is noteworthy because when somebody gets arthritis in their body, that's usually the first joint where it shows up at, right in that joint right there. Okay, so a lot of range of motion. And then the third one is a ball and socket. Okay, like we see right here with the shoulder joint, with the head of the humerus. And the other ball and socket joint would be the hip joint. Okay. Now I do want to go back. I want to go back to the shoulder joint. I'd mentioned this before, and I want to mention it again. It's not labeled. So can you see the outline of the scapula right here? Not very deep, but can you see this other tissue right here? All right, so this is some cartilage, some fibrocartilage, and it actually extends the depth of the glenoid fossa. And this thing right here is called the glenoid labium, okay, or lip, or labrum, glenoid labrum, and that just helps stabilize the shoulder joint. But since it's not bone, since it's soft tissue, it can become damaged pretty easily, all right, but that helps stabilize the shoulder joint. All right, and there's one joint that I want you to become familiar with. All right, so it's not the temporomandibular joint, but here you can see the meniscus or the articular disc in the temporomandibular joint. So this is the full joint cavity right here. This is that articular disc. But the other joint that has an articular disc is the knee. So I'm going to proceed to the knee, and we'll finish up this lecture just by talking about the knee. So here is the knee. So we've got a number of bones. We've got the femur up over here, and we've got the patella, and then laterally we've got the fibula, medially we've got the tibia, and we see a number of tendons that move across the joint on the outside. And what you should be familiar with on this particular figure is the tendon from the quadriceps, which is your anterior thigh muscle, inserts into the superior margin of the patella. And then there is another dense connective tissue that goes from the apex of the patella down to the tibial tuberosity. And strictly speaking, this is not a tendon because it's what? A bone-to-bone connection. This is what we call the patellar ligament. So the tendon is what we call the tendon of the quadriceps femoris, and this ligament between the patella and the tibial tuberosity is the patellar ligament. But it all acts as one structure in terms of directing force. Can anybody kind of get a sense what's the motion that might be produced at the knee when the quadriceps contract and put tension on the patellar ligament? What's going to happen? Well, your leg is going to move, not your thigh. And the way your leg is going to move, if I put tension on this ligament right here, is that it's going to extend my leg. So that's extension. Okay, so those parts you have to know. But we also see on the outside, either the, they're superficial, either medially or laterally, we have collateral ligaments. All right? So here is the fibular collateral ligament going from epicondyle on the femur to the head of the fibula. And here is the tibial collateral ligament that goes on the opposite side, on the medial side. So these are the collateral ligaments, and probably you've heard of some of these ligaments already, because if somebody's knee is abducted or abducted, all right, so the knee is basically what kind of joint? It's a hinge joint, right? Okay, so it flexes and extends, a couple other little minor motions in there, but basically it's strictly a hinge joint. But if your leg adducts or abducts, then these are the ligaments that are damaged or ripped. And these ligaments go by different names. Right, so the fibular collateral ligament is the same as, anybody know what, it has another name? It's not named by the bone, but by the position in the body. The fibula is lateral. So the fibular collateral ligament sometimes is called the lateral collateral ligament. And the tibial collateral ligament is sometimes called the medial collateral ligament. As a matter of fact, those terms are used more commonly than the others. All right, so we learned these two, and then on the outside. Now let's look at the inside of the knee. So let's move some of these tendons and ligaments out of the way. Okay, I do see something that I'm not going to ask you to label on a test, but you should know a little bit what this term right here means, retinaculum. A retinaculum is something that's not quite as strong as a tendon or a ligament. It's thinner, and usually it's broader in nature, but it is stabilizing. So a retinaculum is dense connective tissue that's working at a joint. It provides some stability. Right, but I'm sure you've heard of the collateral ligaments and the patellar ligaments before. All right, so let's look to the inside of the knee. So now we have a sagittal section of the knee, and we can see some things that we were looking at already, namely the quadriceps muscle and the tendon of the quadriceps inserting into the patella, and then the patellar ligament going into the tibial tuberosity. Oh, and look what we have. We have a bursa right here, okay? And I think we have another bursa right here, right? The deep intrapatellar bursa, because your knee, when your quadriceps contract, it really pounds, puts a lot of force instantaneously on these ligaments, and that would produce an inflammation of the knee, but these bursa help distribute that force and prevent inflammation. So I'm going to have to zoom in here so I can see what I'm talking about. Ah, that's helpful. Okay. So this is a nice synovial joint. So where do we start when we start looking for a synovial joint? Hyaline cartilage right here. We have the joint cavity filled with synovial fluid and the synovial membrane, okay, which would be right on this surface over here and this surface over here. I don't think it's labeled because that's not what we're really trying to look at in this particular figure, but we're right smack in the middle of the knee. So if we're looking right smack in the middle of the knee, do we see the collateral ligaments, the medial or lateral collateral ligaments? So we don't see it on this particular slide, but we see some other ligaments. All right, we see these that form an X in the very center of the knee. These are what we call the cross ligaments or cruciate ligaments. All right, and you've probably heard of those. And here is the anterior cruciate ligament. Here's the posterior cruciate ligament. They're named by how they insert into the intercondylar eminence right between the condyles at the head of the tibia. So can you picture that intercondylar eminence? It's almost that pointy region between the condyles of the tibia. And the job of this anterior cruciate ligament is to prevent, right, protraction of the knee. Because the knee, your leg shouldn't be able to slide anterior and it shouldn't be able to slide posterior with respect to each other. It should be nice and stable. So the anterior cruciate ligament prevents protraction of the knee and the posterior cruciate ligament prevents the retraction of the knee. So sometimes when you get your knee checked out, the physician will have you sit down and he'll move your leg forward or backwards just to check what ligaments. These cruciate ligaments right here. And if they're stretched out, then he knows that's a cruciate ligament injury. And which one? If you can protract your knee, that's the anterior cruciate ligament. If you can retract it, that's the posterior cruciate ligament. And if you can do both, if you can wiggle that leg when you shouldn't be able to wiggle it around like that, then that's damage to both of those. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it produces that little jerk. He hits that patellar ligament, okay, and that stretches the quadriceps femoris. But so something is stretching that quadriceps femoris, but the quadriceps is voluntary muscle, skeletal muscle, and you didn't tell the quadriceps to contract, and all of a sudden it's being stretched, or you didn't tell it to stretch. All of a sudden it's being stretched. There are reflexes that prevent that because you didn't tell the muscle to do that. Okay, so the physician or somebody is checking that reflex. So it's a check for a reflex that protects your body. All right, so these are the cruciate ligaments. And the other thing that we see, or should see, in this diagram, okay, are the fibrocartilage pads, or the articular discs. These are what we call menisci that are in the knee. And these just help form a more proper fit between the condyles of the femur, right, and the condyles of the tibia. So these are C-shaped fibrocartilages that help stabilize the knee. And here is the lateral meniscus, right? Here is the medial meniscus. This would be the anterior horn. This would be the posterior horn of the meniscus. And when it goes from this lateral edge to either one of these horns, that meniscus gets really, really thin. And when it gets thinner, what happens to the strength? As it gets weaker, right? So these are the areas right here, the tips of the menisci typically are the ones that get ripped or broken off, okay, and then you have to figure out what to do from there. Hopefully you can just go in and remove just a very, very little piece of it, hopefully not the whole meniscus. Because if you remove the whole meniscus, what might be the downside of that? The meniscus is designed to be in there to do something. It's making sure that the femur, right, and the tibia don't rub up against each other. So when you take it out, one of the side effects will be arthritis as a result of that, because this hyaline cartilage now will be eroded away from those two bones. Okay, so here you can see the tibial tuberosity, so you know that's the anterior part of this joint. So those are the things that you have to know. The cruciate ligaments, the menisci, the patellar ligament, the tendon of the quadriceps, as well as the collateral ligaments. So there's about 8 or 10 things in the knee, but it's not really difficult once you look at it. And you probably talked about all these things already. Okay, so just look at that figure, and you should be able to classify this joint by a number of different criteria, by its function and its structure. Okay, so that's it for today.